Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Clinical Signs Podcast. My name is Dr. Matthew Panarella. We're up for episode 13. 13. Lucky 13. Anyway, today's topic is going to be a little bit off the beaten path, probably for most of you. But if you're in the medical profession or you have any interest in the medical profession, this might interest you. So I'm going to pose a question to you first. When you've seen, and we've all seen this, whether you've seen it in a movie or a television program, is somebody has a syringe and a needle, and they pull the cap off the needle, and then they are flicking the syringe to, quote unquote, you know, they're trying to get the air out. Well, why are they trying to get the air out? They're very dramatic about it. They make a big show of it. I guess that's what Hollywood enjoys, is the drama of the whole thing. And why are they trying to get the air out? Well, they're trying to get the air out technically, because if they're going to make an injection, especially into a vein, they don't want to call what's called, they don't want to cause a vascular air embolism. So in Hollywood's fashion, they make it traumatic. I would hazard to guess that nobody in the medical profession, including veterinary medicine, would do anything like that, because I've never really done that. When you're drawing up, I will just say for practical purposes, when someone is drawing up a drug, there's very few circumstances where there actually is going to be a large amount of air in the syringe or the needle. When you're drawing up a drug from a vial, you have to invert the vial. So the vial is already above the needle and syringe. You puncture the gasket. There's a special, probably not just rubber, but it's a rubber-like gasket at the vial, the neck of the vial, that you wipe first with alcohol to sterilize that. That's just good practice procedure. You let it dry. You puncture the rubber stopper, so to speak, with the needle, and then you withdraw. You're pulling back on the plunger from the syringe. Now, when you're doing this, you have to draw up a very specific amount, because that's how we practice medicine. We practice medicine by giving certain amounts of drugs. So in veterinary medicine, we do calculations usually based on body weight, and usually based on the metric system body weights of kilograms, which to us Americans is kind of weird, but it's the way we do it. And you do a calculation before you draw up the drug. And so then, based on the concentration of that drug, you are going to draw up a particular volume of that drug. And when you're pulling back on the plunger, or when you're pulling back on the plunger, you are pulling down into the body of the syringe a particular volume of liquid. Now, sometimes when you pull that fluid out, there's going to be air bubbles. And what you're doing is, when you become a skilled person, you're holding the needle, syringe, and vial all in one hand. And then that's when you are flicking, per se, the barrel of the syringe to knock out any air. But most of the time, if you draw past the line of the volume that you want to draw, and then you push some fluid back into the vial, remember, everything is still connected, you're going to eliminate 99.99% of the bubbles. Occasionally, you might have a very small bubble. That's not dramatic. And I guess if you're making a movie or a television program, you're going to show something that people don't really do, but you know, most people, you know, how many people are in a medical profession or the veterinary profession, you know, as a percentage of the population, it's really not that great a number. So the general public is going, ooh, you know, your mind is going to just tell you, oh, that must be the way they really do it. It's not the way we do it, unless something strange were to happen. And it would be good practice to also check your syringe prior to making any injection. Now, a lot of times in human medicine, they're using special devices, basically spring-loaded devices, where a lot of times you don't even need a needle. They're spring-loaded devices that can be used in IV lines, in fluid lines, or that attach to the vial itself, that are spring-loaded, that eliminate the need for a needle. And that's because of needle sticks. One of the more common, I would say, injuries in the medical profession would be a needle stick. And of course, in human medicine, you don't want to get stuck with a needle that's been inside a patient for transmission of certain bloodborne diseases such as hepatitis or immunodeficiency virus, have contracted an illness from a needle stick. Back when needles were basically the only choice, people have been accidentally stuck using the pressure, the spring-loaded devices, basically eliminates needle sticks. And that's probably why they were designed in the end of the 20th century based on those pretty serious infectious diseases. If you eliminate, the more needles you can eliminate, the more better chance, less chance per se, of a human being getting stuck by accident. In veterinary medicine, we worry about it. We do use those. We do worry about needle sticks, depending on what species of animal you're working with and what diseases those animals can carry. Yes, there are still diseases that can be spread via a needle stick, that's for sure. And we also do use the spring-loaded devices too, sometimes to eliminate the use of needles. Getting back to the air in the syringe, 99.9% of the time, you're going to have little to no air when you do the method that I told you about. And you're always going to check your practice, because you don't want to inject air into the patient. So Hollywood's dramatic. It's not really real life. Ha ha, surprise, surprise. But that's the way it is. So let's talk a little bit more. If we're going to talk about what's called a vascular air embolism, we need to talk about some units of measure. I guess this is also sort of basic to understanding of how veterinary medicine works. But when you're using syringes have labels on them indicating numbers, and that's the volume or the amount of that liquid that you're drawing up. The numbers on the syringes represent mLs or cc's. So again, we use the metric system here. For those of you that are unhappy with that, well, it's actually relatively simple, because everything is based out of 1 or 100 or 10, as opposed to the US system, which we're going to talk about in a second here, based on volume units of measure. So in medicine, we use milliliters or cc's, which is cubic centimeters. So 1 mL or 1 milliliter is exactly the same as 1 cc or 1 cubic centimeter. Those things are equivalent. So what is an mL? An mL is 1/1000th of a liter of fluid. Now, again, also probably a lot of people have seen in TVs and movies, fluid bags being used, on people, probably not so much on animals, it'd be more common in people, but a relatively common size fluid bag would be a 1 liter bag of, let's say, physiologic saline, 0.9% sodium chloride, hanging on an IV stand or IV pole with a fluid line attached to it, attached to the patient via an IV catheter. A cc or cubic centimeter is 1 cubic centimeter, so that would work out to be 1 cc times 1 cc times 1 cc, which is 1 cc. So if you think about things for 1 second, these two equivalents, the milliliter and the cubic centimeter, are denoting a particular volume. And if you think about it for a second, a cubic centimeter, it's a little square. It's a little cube, basically, and 1 mL of fluid would fit within that entire, 1 centimeter cube on all, 1 centimeter on all sides. So an inch is 2.54 centimeters. So 1 centimeter is less than half an inch. It's around 0.4 of an inch, basically. So it's a relatively small space. Now, a couple other comparisons, just because we're Americans and we think in different terms. So 1 liter, okay, is equal to 0.26 of a U.S. gallon. So it's slightly more than a quarter of a gallon. 4 liters is, again, slightly more than 1 U.S. gallon. It's 1.06 of a U.S. gallon. And then 1 U.S. gallon is 3,790 milliliters or 3.79 liters. That's just to give you a reference point. And so a lot of times people have a hard time. You might have a hard time imagining the size of things. But today, if you look on your gallon container of milk, you will see that they will usually have 3.79 liters. If you look at the bottom, usually of the labels, especially milk gallons, they'll have it. So that's volume units of measure And you also need to be aware of this because when I get to some specifics, I'm going to be talking a little bit about numbers just to give you a relative breakdown between different species. So what is a vascular air embolism? A vascular air embolism is a result of air entering the bloodstream, especially on the venous side of the circulation. Now, for the most part, when we make injections into the bloodstream or going into the vein, okay, because that system then is allowed to be, if you inject into the vein, the item injected is going to go to the liver and then it's going to be, and then it goes into the liver. But then from the liver, we know it goes up to the heart and then it's pumped out to the rest of the body, okay? If you go into the arterial side, so if you make an intra-arterial injection, I was previously talking about an intravenous injection. If you make an intra-arterial injection, what's going to happen is that drug, if we use the example of a drug, that drug is now going to be pushed down. Let's say you make an injection into femoral artery in the leg. That injection is now going to go down the leg into the foot. And that might be what you want to accomplish. There are certain techniques that, you know, if you want to distribute something to an artery or to a particular tissue, you can do it through an injection. There's also other ways to limit venous backflow to the heart. You can inject into the vein to localize to a region an injection. An intra-arterial injection is basically going to be ineffective because most of the time we're making injections to distribute drugs to the entire body. And if you put it into an artery, you're going to limit it to one region of the body, and therefore it's going to be ineffective. So most of the time we're really just talking about intravenous access or IV access. That's what the IV stands for. So ideally, in medical practice, you do not want to inject any air at all into the system. Okay, the system has some flexibility in it, but it's not ideally designed to handle air. So what are the causes of a vascular air embolism? And most of them are iatrogenic. Now, there's an interesting word. I haven't used it before, but iatrogenic basically means it's doctor-caused or it's caused by people and how we care for or manipulate in the medical field, in the veterinary medical field, how we are working on the animal, that we're the ones causing the problem. So iatrogenic basically means doctor-caused. And it would occur through processes such as surgery, because obviously surgery, you're opening up the body. Any IV access, such as an injection or placing an IV catheter. An IV catheter is just a special piece of medical equipment that allows ready access to the vascular space. Mucosal access, so any dental surgeries or any manipulation of the urinary tract. And there are techniques called a pneumocystogram. There's a technique called a pneumocystogram where you can actually inject air, for example, into the bladder. And anytime that air is pushed into the body may absorb some of it. So let's talk about the lethal doses. Now, lethal meaning that it's going to cause a fatality, okay? So lethal doses, I have four species of animals here. So let's start out with the smallest is a rabbit. A rabbit takes very little on a milliliter per kilogram basis. So kilograms, you'd have to weigh the rabbit. And let's say a rabbit weighs 3 kilos. So rabbits take 0.5 to 0.7 milliliters per kilogram. So if a rabbit weighs 3 kilos, you can see that 1.5 to 2.1 mLs of air in the venous side of that animal could kill it. Now, it seems like a lot. It's really not that much. Now, making an injection, there would have to be a catastrophe when you're making that IV injection to inject that much air. But repeated injections over maybe a relatively short period of time where somebody was not really paying attention, was injecting little bits of air, a half a mil, you know, you're really not talking about a lot of volume. And if you have to give an animal a large injection, the larger the volume you're going to inject, the more risk there is of injecting air. So if you had to do several injections over a short period of time, that could happen. Or if you're giving an animal IV fluids, and what you have to do is when you're giving an animal IV fluids, and the same in a person, you have to puncture that bag with the drip set. There's a little spike on the end of the drip set that you push into the bag. And then you have to let the fluid run down the IV tubing, and you have to get the air out. Now, occasionally, it's not that difficult actually to miss some pockets of air. And I don't know the volume inside those IV lines, but that's one critical place for people to check, veterinary nurses to check, veterinarians to check that they've gotten out as much air as possible. Now, that really should be about all the air that's in that tubing. So that's why you have to let the IV fluids run a little bit through the tubing to get the air out. And again, if you have to flick the IV line to get air out, well, then so be it. You really need to do the best you can to get all the air out. And there are mechanical devices. When we give IV fluids, we're generally using gravity. The weight of the bag, is usually above the animal, and gravity is allowing the fluid to drop down. There are also mechanical pumps, different types of pumps. There's pressure bags. There's pressure devices that could be put around the IV fluid bag to increase the rapidity with which the fluid is given. There's IV pumps that go around the IV line, and they just have a mechanical component to it that pulls or pushes the, depending on how you look at it, pulls or pushes the fluid down through the IV line. It can actually measure how much fluid is actually being pumped. So that's a much more definitive way to administer IV fluids. Through the gravity system, it's a little bit more prone to the animal moving, which would be called a positional problem, meaning that the animal shifts position and then it cuts off the flow through either the catheter gets pinched for some reason or the vein. Let's say the animal, the catheter is put in the cephalic vein of a dog, and then the dog pulls its arm back. When it pulls its arm back, it's basically shutting off, it's physiologically and anatomically shutting off most of the flow back from that vein. So therefore, the fluids are not going to enter the system. So rabbits, very small amount of air. Let's go up to cats. Cats, it's a little bit more. Cats, it's 1.2 mLs per kilogram, which is, you know, a cat could be 4 to 5 kilos, basically lean body weight. I'm talking at a cat. There are much heavier cats. A 20-pound cat is 10 pounds of, at least 10 pounds of fat. So, but we're really talking about lean body weight here. 5 ml bolus of air to a 5 kilo cat cause cardiac arrest in one cat. So 5 mils of air actually is quite a bit of air. Again, you want to keep it all to a minimum. I think a lot of problems would be caused by repeated injections over a relatively short period of time, especially maybe in a patient that is compromised, is having problems. Maybe it's already got a cardiac or lung problem. It's going to be an issue for that patient. Dogs, dogs are a little bit more forgiving. It's a much larger volume. It's 7.5 to 15 mLs per kilo. And again, dogs have a very variable range. You can get a little, you know, from a poodle, from a Chihuahua, a relatively small dog, 8, 10 pounds, up to a Great Dane, 150 pounds, even bigger dogs. So it's going to depend on the size of the animal. But 7 to 15 mLs is actually relatively large. It's at least 6 to 10 times the amount that a cat can handle. So a dog has much more zone and ability to actually handle air in its system. So what are we learning here? That rabbits and cats are not that great at handling any air in the vascular space. Dogs are a little bit better at it. Now, human beings lie somewhere between cats and dogs. In man, it's about 3 to 5 mils per kilo. And again, people are of different size, so it would take quite a bit of air to cause a really major problem in a person. But human beings would land between the cat with 1.2 mils per kilo and the dog, let's say at the low end, 7.5. So man is 3 to 5. So it's kind of right in between a cat and a dog. We have some ability to handle some air in our vascular system, but actually relatively not that much. When you think about it, an ounce, this is a rounding up, but an ounce is basically 30 mils of fluid. So an 8-ounce cup of coffee at 8 ounces is 240 mils. So let's say you take a 50 kilo person would weigh on the order of 120 pounds, give or take. 50 kilos times 3 would be 150 mils. So you're talking there 150 would be about 5 ounces of air, which is a relatively large amount. So we do have some capacity to handle some air in the system. So what happens if air actually does get into the system? So we can all handle, and animals as well, can handle relatively small amounts of air. I'm talking tiny bubbles. So small amounts of air head into, if you're going again into the venous system, it's going to go through the liver, through the portal vein, and then it's going to head back to the heart. And then from the heart, it's pumped to the pulmonary artery. And then from the pulmonary artery, it goes directly to the lungs. So once that small bubble passes through, it's going into the lungs, and then it's diffusing out back into the air. Because remember, the lungs, there's a interface of the air and the blood. Now, the red blood cells via the hemoglobin get oxygen and they give up carbon dioxide. So at that one cell division there between the vascular system and the airway, the air bubble will diffuse back out. Okay, and that's all based on pressures, differential pressures in the vascular system and in the alveolus of the lung, which the alveolus is the little air sac. The two most important factors associated with embolism are the amount of air. We just talked about the amount or volume of air injected and the rate at which the air is accumulating in the blood. Again, what I told you, problems will arise if there's a tremendous amount of air injected over a short period of time. So what is the pathophysiology? And what do I mean by pathophysiology? Pathophysiology is really talking about what's causing the problem. So air itself damages the lining of the blood vessels. The lining of the blood vessels is called the vascular endothelium. And when the vascular endothelium is damaged through any mechanism, there's a release of clotting factors and platelets. And that's why the platelets are circulating in your bloodstream. They're there to, they're basically a plug. It's like a finger on a leaky dike or dam. The platelets are coming in to plug that hole. Okay, so any damage to the vascular endothelium is going to trigger the platelets and then trigger the clotting system, which is important to save your life. But sometimes if it gets a little bit overzealous, then that can also be a problem as well. Air can cause pulmonary edema, which is swelling within the lungs. And secondarily, you're getting damage to cells in the lungs, the lining of the alveolus. You're getting release of what's called free radicals. Free radicals are normal cellular waste products. Number one, in the lung, and you have oxygen about and air. Air is, what is it, mostly nitrogen, about 79% nitrogen. There's a smaller component of oxygen around. It's slightly less than 20%. And then there's a few other inert gases. When that air gets into the vascular system and then is being trying to be diffused back out through the lung, it's damaging the cells. And then the free radicals will build up. And free radicals are basically oxygen that is created in the damaged cell. And it's a trigger for the body to say, okay, there's a problem here. We need to clean out this problem and get rid of it. So free radicals are normal. They're normally cleaned up by the body. But if you have an overabundance of them, they're going to cause more and more damage. Also, air causes an obstruction, which can be a partial obstruction or a complete obstruction to outflow from the right ventricle. Okay, so blood, the way the circulatory system works, right, through the cranial and caudal vena cava, that's what we call it. The cranial and caudal vena cava meet at the right atrium, and they're dumping all the blood from the body is eventually going back to the right atrium. Then the right atrium is connected to the right ventricle via the tricuspid valve. Blood is being pumped from the right atrium, passing over the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle. And then from the right ventricle, blood vessels leaving the heart are called arteries. So from the right ventricle, blood passes via the pulmonary artery to the lungs. So you can sort of see now that the right atrium and the right ventricle are chambers. And if there's quite a bit of air in there in a closed system, the air can act as a lock. So you can get an airlock in the right ventricle because air will accumulate there. And if there's an airlock, that means blood is not flowing, and that's a very bad thing. So if there's enough air, you can cause all sorts of problems because now you're shutting off blood flow. So you can stop blood coming out of the heart, which is called cardiac output. Normal blood being pumped from the heart can be measured, and it's called cardiac output. Hypotension, you have a decreased tension pressure in the vascular system because there's less blood in the vascular system. You can have ischemia, which is the cessation or the terminating of blood flow to the heart itself or to the brain, which most likely would be a catastrophe, right? We did say this could be a fatal problem. And you can also cause right-sided heart failure. And of course, I mentioned death. So air, large volumes of air are not good. So less air is actually required in the arterial circulation and the venous circulation to cause harm. So the ideal here is best practice, prevention, prevention, prevention. You want to not inject air at any cost, okay? So that means good technique. That means paying attention. I used to teach students triple check things when you're going to pull a drug off the shelf. A lot of drugs in vials look very similar to each other. Maybe have a similar color. You always want to check that vial 3 times. Okay. I would say too, when you're doing procedures, sometimes it's your brain might be thinking a couple of steps ahead and you're actually doing a technical maneuver. You always want to stop and double check or triple check what you're doing to make sure that you do something like not inject the air, that you're getting the air out of the fluid. So, wrap up, I wanted to talk about what is the difference between a thrombosis and an embolism. So an embolism is anything that's traveling through the circulatory system. So an air bubble by itself is going to be traveling through the circulatory system. There are cases where you can have fat globules traveling through the vascular system, and that happens mostly. I'm sure it can happen in animals, but I think it's a much more likely scenario in people. And I know that it's a complication when people get liposuction is that fat becomes mobilized in the body and you can get a fat embolism. And as we just described with an air embolism, a fat embolism is going to go to the lungs. It's obviously going to go to the heart and it actually can be a fatal problem. And there's one other technique for people in veterinary medicine. When we're giving IV fluids, we want IV, what we call IV access. But sometimes when you have a patient that's extremely dehydrated or in shock, especially in a younger patient, there is a technique to inject IV fluids through the bone marrow. That's intramedullary fluids. And to do that, you do have to push a needle into the bone marrow. And if, number one, just injecting anything into the bone marrow can cause a release of bone marrow contents out to the body, and that can cause an embolism. Also, pumping high volumes of fluid through the bone marrow can cause an embolism. So embolisms, you can see, basically are free-floating things, multiple things, not just air, in the circulatory system. A thrombosis, if you think about it for a moment, I said when the vascular system, the endothelium, which is the lining of the vascular system, gets damaged, the clotting factors are going to be triggered. And when they're triggered, that's going to plug that hole, but it's also potentially going to, it's going to build up on the interior lining of that. Remember that the circulatory system is our tubes. And when you plug that tube, that's a thrombosis, okay? And there's thrombosis of different sizes. A thrombosis can also lead to an embolism where a piece of that thrombosis actually breaks off. It is possible, again, in veterinary medicine, you would need quite an extraordinarily sick animal and to get a major thrombosis. People, it does happen. I know it does happen in women, especially women on birth control are prone to DVTs, which are called deep vein thrombosis. Those are deep, it's a thrombosis inside a deep leg vein, probably, for example, one of the femoral veins, and then that breaks off. So that thrombosis is so large that it's sort of filling up the entire femoral vein, and then a piece of that thrombosis breaks off, and then it goes to the lungs. So not common per se in animals, but probably actually more common in people, although saying that it's not impossible in an animal, we would probably have a much more difficult time actually diagnosing that in an animal versus a human being. So we've actually covered, I think, quite an interesting topic today, a little bit off the beaten path. I'd like to tie into the nonsense of the TV movie Hollywood world and how they handle these things and some good practice, practical tips for veterinarians and veterinary nurses to be very careful when they're making IV injections or they're giving IV fluids. some of the, we also threw in the metric system. So we got a lot going on in this podcast, which I really enjoy. I have a couple of links that will talk about thrombosis and embolism in veterinary medicine. And I have a nice link, relatively easy reading on free radicals. So that's vascular air embolism. I'm Dr. Panarella. This is the 13th podcast of the Clinical Science Podcast. I hope you're all having a good time in 2023, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you.